Accession number 4847, Reel 3.
Major Owen, Reel 3. Was there any twitting of the guards?
Yes. I told you, when we moved from Laufen in October 1941 to Barburg, and where we came into contact with the RAF, the camp at Warburg was a very big camp. It was in on an open plain, and we were in wooden huts. I suppose it might have been a kilometre by 400 metres, let's say, something of that size. It was a big camp anyway, and the RAF had their company, and I was in the company which was alongside of theirs. And yes, the RAF were the leaders in it, and then of course we followed. The security officer was a man called Hager, and Hager used to come on parade, and we used to shout, "I'm Hager, I'm Hager, the begins with C of the Lager." And Hager didn't like this. Hager was a very unpopular man. They led to twitting there. It was done in a more subtle form, I suppose, later on in Eichstätt, where we went in October 1942. But the caliber of the guards had declined then, and they were more inclined to be friendly. And they were older men than those of the earlier years of the war.
Can you tell me what the attitude towards escape was?
Yes. The attitude towards escape certainly was that it was necessary. I did not escape. I was never approached to escape. I realized that it was my job to help others to escape. And so people were given certain jobs. The jobs for most of us were to be stooges. And when the escapees escapers were working on their projects, digging tunnels or making clothes, or as my great friend John Mansell, the forger, forging documents, then we would find ourselves in a place where we were to make signs indicating that the Hun was looking for something, or he was there, and we would make a sign, and of course the work would cease. People would know that the Germans were coming to search or to look. And I would suppose that that was the attitude of most of us. In my mess, before he joined us, one chap escaped. He escaped in the honey wagon.
What was that?
The honey wagon is the wagon which takes the excreta out, sir. I wasn't associated with him then, but he was terrific. Of the other four, I can see there were five of us. One of the five had done this. Of the other four, we would take our turn at stooging.
Were any of the escapes which were attempted from any of the three camps that you were in successful, do you know?
Yes. From the big camp, the one I've referred to in Warburg, the chaps who put the light out, led by Tom Stallard, and put the ladders over the wire. That was a fantastic show. I think it was 30 got over the wire, and of those three, Henry Coombe Tennant, Rupert Fuller, and a chap called Arkwright, Henry Arkwright, I think his name was, they all eventually got back to England. I think it was absolutely fabulous show, terrific. And all good luck to them.
To what extent were you and your fellow POWs able to keep abreast of what was happening in the world outside?
Well, there was the Dickey Bird, and I suppose we first started to disseminate news, I suppose after maybe 2 or 3 months.
What do you mean by the Dickey Bird?
The Dickey Bird was the radio. I didn't know where the radio was located, although in the last camp I was in, I would read the news. The news was... I would take it down somewhere. And then would read it in our block, in the last camp I was in Eichstätt. In our staircase, I would read the news about 4 times, and of course it was the BBC news.
What do you think was the contribution to the morale and general state of feeling of the POWs of being able to get what news you could?
Oh, I think it was. I think it was tremendous. I think it was absolutely tremendous.
Even during the early period when the defeats were coming in.
Yes, I think it was. I think at least we knew where we stood, and I think that was very important to know exactly where we stood. I think in the earlier days of the war, we used to news was culled from the Völkische Beobachter. Which is the main Nazi newspaper. It was culled from that. And of course, eventually, the Germans had to admit in their newspapers, we could see the Völkische Beobachter. The Germans had to admit that that defeats were taking place, that they weren't always victories, that they were being defeated in North Africa and that they were being defeated in Russia and that there was a disaster at Stalingrad, etc.
Can you remember any specific piece of news that did do a great deal for morale?
That did a great deal for morale? Yes. And it was a long time to come. I suppose the success at Alamein and the encirclement and retaking by the Russians of Stalingrad, I would say that those were the two highlights. It must be remembered that we were joined by prisoners from North Africa. Well, even before then, we were joined by prisoners from Greece and Crete. And then we were joined by prisoners from Dieppe. And, of course, we were put into handcuffs. The Canadian prisoners were put into handcuffs. Initially, in retaliation, because some German prisoners had been handcuffed or something other like that in Canada, or maybe before, I don't know. Anyway, so the Germans retaliated, we retaliated, and then we used to take it in turns to be in handcuffs in Eichstätt, and you wore your handcuffs all day. It became rather a farce in the end.
Why was that?
because I think you could take your handcuffs off, or you could find a way to get someone to undo your handcuffs. But I suppose, really, we were flabbergasted when Tobruk went the last time, when it went. When the Allied forces landed in North Africa, and when Alamein started, I thought, well, really, we felt this was, things are really going to start happening. And of course, subsequently, one of the camps, the last camp I was in for 2.5 years, Eichstätt, which was between, I think it's Munich and Nuremberg, you would see the, you get the air raids, and on their way to Regensburg or to Schweinfurt, you'd see them in the daytime, and then of course they'd have them at night time, and that no doubt was raised morale. At least we thought we were going to get somewhere.
You've talked about the prisoners who came in later, who were captured in later years. How did they fit in with the 1940 vintage prisoners? Did they fit in easily, or was there any conflict?
I don't think there was really any conflict. No, I think they came in and they joined us reasonably normally. I don't think there's any conflict. No.
So the fact of being a POW for 5 years was not substantially different from being a POW for, say, 2 or 3 years?
I think the period of time certainly counted. I think of the fact that the chap was a prisoner for let's say, I mean, in the end we were getting chaps from Kos, and I think Kos, which was in the East Mediterranean, I think Kos was in it might have been September 1944. Anyway, it was in 44 sometime. Those chaps were prisoners, fellows from Arnhem. Remember getting the Padre Harlow from Arnhem. And he'd been captured in North Africa and escaped. He was a terrific chap. And I think that the time element certainly affected one. I'm quite convinced that the time element affected one.
Can you be more specific how you mean?
Well, I think one was getting tired. One had wondered longer, when was it going to end? I think the effect of malnutrition also affected us. I think people were hungry. One of the main recollections I have is that I was hungry for 5 years. I can feel my tummy. I was hungry for 5 years. One of the great joys we had when Red Cross parcels, you get a full Red Cross parcel. It's your turn, Charles, for the condensed milk. You can have a whole tin of condensed milk for yourself. To bash a tin of Condaggers was really something, and you bashed your tin of Condaggers and enjoyed it.
Condaggers?
Yes. Condaggers was condensed milk. The Red Cross parcels contained a tin of condensed milk, which we knew as Condaggers. That was something. What chap said? I wouldn't have to tell you. So. Anyway,
absolute luxury.
Well, it was, yes. But you got your full tin. You see, it rotated. If there was a parcel today, well, Charles, it's your turn for a tin of Condaggers. I couldn't no more bash a full tin of condensed milk now if they make it. I don't know. I could no more do it than fly. But then, my God, I could.
Did you or any of the people you were with have any contact with the German civilian population?
I had absolutely no contact with the German civilian population. One of the chaps to whom I've referred, who was terrific, the chap who did an escape in the honey wagon. He organized wood chopping parties, and they used to bring in wood from the forests and these pine cones, so that we could have some form of fuel in the last 2 years of the war. Incidentally, the Red Cross parcels contained dried milk in the form of Klim milk reversed, Klim tins, and out of these Klim tins we used to make reasonably effective cookers, and with odd bits of paper, that sort of thing, we could brew up tea from these Klim tins.
So there was contact with German civilians through this work party, was there?
Through this work, there might have been contact, but I think it was pretty severely curtailed and restricted. In fact, I think eventually the parties that went out for fuel, I think they had to be stopped.
Did you suffer from the cold then?
Yes, quite certainly. The first winter. The first winter, I think we wore Polish greatcoats. The first winter we really did. And then I got a pair of submarine boots. My mother sent me out a pair of submarine boots, which I specifically asked for, and I wore those. Damn lucky I was to have them. I wore those, and funnily enough, I still have them. They're still at my home in Henley-on-Thames. I wore those in the winters for the last 3 winters.
You said that there was this woodcutting party to collect fuel, but did the Germans not supply with any fuel at all?
Oh yes, I think we got a small amount of fuel. I think we obviously got to, we got by somehow anyway. So I mean, I don't recall chaps dying of cold or anything like that. We got by somehow. So
did you have blankets?
Oh yes. We had maybe a blanket. Then you got blankets in your Red Cross parcels, I think. You slept in, you had your palliasse, and then you had a sort of sheet thing, double sheet thing, which you changed every what, 3 weeks to a month, which they would change for you, or they'd wash for you, or something other like that.
Was there any suffering from anything in the form of vermin, like bugs or lice?
No, I don't think so. The straw in your palliasses was changed every so often, and of course the Germans are fairly fairly clinical about lice and vermin, so I think they were pretty keen to see that that didn't exist, or that was minimised.
Were you in any of the camps that you were in contact with POWs of other nationalities?
We were never. Oh yes, well, we were. There were Poles. Particularly Poles. There was a Syrian in one camp, Alfred Sharma. Of course, it was from him, but he was a member of the Pioneer Corps, and it was from Alfred Sharma that I first started to learn Arabic. There were South Africans. There were around my mess. There were Australians. New Zealanders, but I think maybe you're referring to Russians at Warburg. I think it was Warburg, the second camp. There were Russians in a lager alongside the camp, and of course they were in appalling conditions, and it used to distress us that there was little we could do about it.
Why were there conditions appalling?
Well, I think they were bedraggled. I think they had no food. You know, they were going to die. I mean, I don't think there was any question of them. They were not human in the eyes of the Germans.
Was there any disease problem with them?
I would suspect there was, but they were kept just far enough. They were the other side of the fence. They were kept far enough away so we had no contact with them.
You've talked generally about conditions in all three camps, and you've also drawn the distinction between morale at Warburg as compared with Laufen. But can you say in what other possible ways the three camps, Laufen, Warburg and Eichstätt, were different?
Yes. I would say that Laufen, we were new. We thought we might be home by Christmas. It was always home by Christmas. I think I was lucky in this myself. I think I somehow or other had acclimatized myself to the fact, well, I don't know how long this is going to go on, but you better realize it's going to go on a long time, or possibly a long time. And this obviously took time. Maybe it took about 18 months before one really realized that, well, I'm in this, and I don't really know when it's going to end. And it's, I really can't really worry me all that much more. Just go on day. In Laufen, there was fun, largely because of the RAF. And also that there was this exceptional escape, and it was a large camp, and it was a varied camp, and when we moved from there in October 1942 to Eichstätt was much more orderly as a camp. It felt much more permanent. And of course I was to be in Eichstätt until I think it was March of 1945. It was a much more organized camp, and it was the camp in which we saw the beginning of our victories, and the hope that the war would be over by Christmas. We all hoped the war would be over by the Christmas of 1944. It wasn't. Arnhem failed, and I think we were all a bit upset by that.
Did you receive news of the Ardennes offensive?
Oh yes.
How was that received?
Well, it's a long time now, but I would think we believed then that we didn't think it would be successful. We knew enough about what was going on the Eastern Front, the progress that the Russians are making on the Eastern Front. I think we knew enough then to know that it really wasn't going to make all that much difference, and that it really was not going to be successful.
Can you describe the circumstances of how you came to be marched out of Eichstätt camp in April 1945?
Yes, the air raids were becoming more and more frequent. I suppose we knew that the war was getting closer and closer to us, and then several days beforehand we received information that we were to be marched out. We had acquired belongings by then. I of course had studied and lectured, and those were my most important possessions, the ones which I wish to retain. So we were told more or less what we could take. The rest was to be packed up, and it was put into a sort of riding stable shed place on the camp. And I can see some fellows on the first morning we marched out, they were pushing things rather like prams with piano turntables as wheels. We were all grossly overloaded with what we had on us, and we set out. And I don't suppose the tail of the column had got out of the camp. In fact, the tail of the column had not got out of the camp when the American Air Force set on us. And the American Air Force went up and down that column for about half an hour.
This was a strafing attack.
A strafing attack on us. Of course, we couldn't believe that this was happening. I found myself lying up against a wall, and up against that wall I lay for the next half hour. Just couldn't possibly believe that this was happening to us. I understand that the American Air Force thought we were Hungarians, who maybe wore the same sort of uniform. Anyway, eventually they went away, having killed and a number of prisoners and badly wounded a number. And back we went. We left more of our goods, and if we didn't march out the following morning, we certainly marched out the morning after.
Was there any bitterness about this strafing attack, or were people philosophical?
So. No, we weren't philosophical about it. No, I think we were very bitter about it. I think also you must remember that we'd had 5 years of this now. And really, it was getting a bit much. I myself had been taken to hospital in October of 1944. I could see myself walking from the silence room back to my the room in which I think it was 11A in Block 2 at Eichstätt. I could see myself walking back there, really, absolutely, you know, in my heavy boots, you know, sort of feeling, well, I really can't go on. And eventually, I suppose I just couldn't get out of bed. And I was taken to hospital and looked after and survived. People were jolly good about it. Some years later, I was to go to Canada, and of course, they picked up TB. And I'm quite convinced that I got TB in October 1944. Absolutely convinced of it.
So you were saying that by this time you were really fed up, and so that you hadn't taken this strafing attack philosophically.
No, we hadn't taken, not at all. No, it was, you know, it was far from it. It's, I mean, a number of fellows who'd been prisoners for Ben Jickling, one of them I know, a great pal of mine, he'd been POW 5 years, he was dead. Eric Arden, who played the piano, lost his arm. He lost his arm. I mean, this was terrible, you see. At the end of that period of time, this had to happen. So
you'd said that you'd gone back to camp and then had set off very soon afterwards.
That's right.
So what happened
and,
then?
And then we marched crossed the Danube at Ingolstadt. We marched and we slept out in the open, and I don't know how long that went on for. I don't know. I really can't recall. It might have been up to 3 weeks. I doubt if it was as long as that. Anyway, 14 days to 3 weeks. We just marched. And finally ended up at a place called Moosburg, which was another very large camp in which there were prisoners of all nationalities. And there we bedded down. There was some form of order in the place. I suppose we knew that the war was coming to an end. I was approached because of my knowledge of languages